we're learning this in science right now because I want to learn what y'all are learning in social studies, and let's connect that, because I'm not sure if they're talking about the climate across this massive geography in social studies. And I saw it with my own eyes, just how big of an area that we're talking about in China myself. Like, let's learn. And by the end of the week, let's be able to talk about it. And we did that. And it was a very small change with a very large result that kind of embedded the why without even a lot of effort. So it could be just the change that I needed to do to get through to these very short attention spans. But it was the first time in months that I was able to finish a story and finish a storyline with them so that they could see the why instead of just thinking that they were going to the science class.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.
Hello, Renaissance people, and those of you seeking to cultivate a Renaissance mindset. It is Sarah Kobilka, the Renaissance woman, coming to you live from the closet in my bedroom in an attempt to get better audio quality for my podcast. We'll see how this goes. Anyways, I welcome you back to another episode with a guest, and I am back to talking to people that I've known for a long time. This episode is what happens when you put me in a room, a virtual room with one of my friends from grad school. Today I'm going to be talking to Jess Rowell, and we both went to Montana State University at Bozeman. It was actually a virtual grad school, so we didn't meet in person until the very end when we were finishing school. We are going to go diving pretty deep into some of the stuff that we were talking about and that we were studying in school. So this was a Master's of Science in Science Education program, but fear not, I tried my very best to define some of the jargon that came up. There may be some things that are not familiar to you coming to you from the world of formal education, in which case I encourage you to jump into the show notes, because I put all kinds of resources. If we start talking about things that kind of sound interesting to you, I would encourage you to jump in there and check it out. What were some of the things that we talked about? Well, once again, Venn diagrams had a little bit of a love fest. We talk about the difference between science versus STEM, STEAM, STEM with two M's, STREAM, all that alphabet soup of different acronyms that there are out there. We discussed all the work that Jess has been doing for integrating academic subjects across the school day for students. She shared a little bit about the unique impact that the COVID-19 pandemic had on the students that she is currently teaching. Some of these things are actually going to be pretty surprising to you. I know they surprised me. I got on a little bit of a tangent about my dislike of the term learning loss, and just shared a wonderful message that resonates whether you're a teacher or anyone just talking and trying to communicate with another person, which is all focused on the why. So sit back, relax. Don't forget to have your favorite drink so that you can take a drink with all these wonderful show notes. And here we go. And so I will ask you, Jess, the question that I've asked every single one of my guests and that I have found absolutely intriguing and helps me create the title of your episode. Which of these terms aligns best with your identity? Renaissance person, man, woman, whatever it might be, multi-passionate, generalist, versatilist, Jack, Jill, Jay of all trades, boundary spanner, or is there something else that you've come across that really aligned with who you think of when you think of yourself?
I love that question, that thought exercise. I love that it comes to me mid-career to really think about it. Even though you've been working on that message with me and your colleagues for 10 years or more, I've always resonated with the Renaissance person, especially because of the inspiration from Da Vinci and how I wanted to be the Da Vinci of curriculum and instruction, and I still kind of do. But I also like the Jack or Jill of more than one trade. I think that, especially going into the world of AI and finding our place in that and what it means for us doing what we do as educators, or at least for me, that's where I like, well, I kind of see being able to speak in multiple industries as a handy function too. So it's kind of a tie between the two, but you had me at Renaissance, Sarah.
Excellent. Well then, fellow Renaissance woman, Jess Rowell, I am absolutely delighted to have you on my podcast. As Jess mentioned, we have known each other for quite some time. We actually met back in grad school when we were working on our Master's of Science in Science Education through Bozeman's Montana State University. What was unique about that particular program, though, is that
that it was almost entirely virtual, and this was also pre-pandemic. So you and I got very good at asynchronous learning, a jargon term from the world of education. We learned how to have virtual meetings, how to provide feedback to each other. It was a very interesting thing to have that in my back pocket, and I imagine you've also experienced this. To have that experience in your back pocket and then to have the COVID-19 pandemic shut down the world and force us all to work in a virtual space, I almost felt slightly more prepared than a lot of people.
Yeah, I had very few issues related to me at that time. In fact, that was a time where I shone. I was like, well, I've been doing this for years. I don't know why everybody else is new to this. Teaching virtually synchronously every day was a new challenge, but we'd had so much background from connections virtually that it really did pay off during COVID.
Excellent. Well, that gets me to my very first question, asking about those areas of expertise that you have. So what are some of those areas of expertise? Where are you a known quantity?
A known quantity? My goodness. I had never really considered just how varied my background was until these conversations with you since grad school and all the work that we did as that kind of reconnaissance at that time. And since then, I've kind of come full circle, realizing that I've got the informal education from the nonprofit sector. I've got the space education and the space exploration education from my days at Space Center, and then corporate education from building curriculum programs state and nationwide, and now formal education for a decade in the classroom. So it's been a real gift that my career has given me so many different types of roles, but all within the same Venn diagram of curriculum and instruction.
Venn diagram. You know, that should become another one of my take a drink things. You'll hear take a drink because we're going to be throwing a lot in the show notes. And I get very excited and tell people take a drink of whatever you want to hydrate yourself with. Jess, you got your drink handy? Okay.
Coffee.
She is ready. She's got her yellow Yeti and thrown it back. When you were teaching formal classroom, what grade levels did you teach?
I've been fortunate to be primarily focused on sixth grade, but I've also done a lot of eighth grade. So this is the second year that I'm teaching both sixth and eighth grade. And this is the second year that I've now taught what I call repeat business. So I'm teaching eighth graders that I also taught as sixth graders in one of the smaller schools in my county in Maryland. So it's not my first time having that experience, but even so, it's a completely transformative experience when you get to teach kids that you've already taught. So I teach science and I also help with the STEM program. And in sixth grade, I primarily run the planning portion of our professional learning communities. So I get to run all of the sixth grade curriculum, all of the sixth grade outdoor education coordination, all of the invent the future or their STEM and invention focused programs. I have gotten to help with those. It's a wild experience having been immersed with this particular age span for 10 years now, especially when you teach the families, all the younger siblings that go through. I've now gone through multiple full families.
Oh, I love that. I do want to ask a question. It's something that I'm familiar with, but I don't think everyone is. You differentiated between science and STEM. And mm-hmm. I think in a lot of cases, those two things get conflated. I think some of the people involved in the other letters in STEM oftentimes feel like people say STEM professionals, and then from then on, they say scientists. And I know some engineers in particular who get their feathers ruffled by that. But what do you see is the difference between the two, and why is it important for us to differentiate between science and STEM?
Well, I mean, you're hitting on such a huge passion topic. We could be here for days on that. I see both sides of the coin on this one, especially after 10 years in practice. So there's the one side that science is being able to explain scientific phenomena. That's the main reason that we walk into a room full of completely different human beings with very little like levels in their learning. Science, especially, we just kind of get them all in one class. You have all the learning levels in one class. And with that knowledge of like taking how to help them think critically and how to help them explain scientific phenomenon, then what? What do we do with it? well, let's learn how to use technology to solve problems. So that's how I've approached it with my pedagogy and practice in the last decade. I do think I stand out from my peers in that way, in that I can't change the fact that the course that I teach is called Investigations in Earth Science or Physical Science or Life Science, depending on the grade. But I can help bridge that pedagogy to the T and the E and the M in STEM. Then on the other side of the token, I help with the STEM-focused courses. And I have a very secondary role in those courses. But in those courses, even as an assist, I help with the outreach of helping families know why we're working together to solve problems and how we're solving those problems, doing the engineering design process to identify problems, put some place-based education in there of why are we trying to solve this problem in our community? And then, you know, if it's an invention-based or some sort of computation-based process that they're building to solve the problem that they've identified, that puts the STEM in it. And as much as I would love to have that 100% integrated in at least my school or my campus or where I have any sphere of influence, those two aren't synonymous. They really are different skill sets. Learning how to describe stuff and learning how to solve stuff are two different tasks. And those tasks have been bifurcated into a science classroom versus your STEM course. So there's pluses and minuses that come with that. But fortunately, when you work with that age range, as long as they see you every day, and as long as you're providing those bridges of, oh, well, let's use technology to solve that problem in science, and let's use what we learned in science to try to identify this problem in our community and use STEM, technology, engineering, and math to solve the problem, to build something to solve it, at least they see the relationship between those two disciplines.
That's interesting. When I think about those disciplines, and I try to explain it to people, so I talk similarly to you, which makes sense because we both went to the same grad school, and talk about how, you know, science is trying to explain phenomenon. It's observing something and asking why and trying to figure out why it's happening. Engineering, you know the solution, but you don't know how you're going to get there. And you have constraints put on you, and then you have to solve the problem within those constraints. Technology are those tools that both scientists and engineers use, and sometimes the engineers are building the technology. And then I see math as the language spoken by all of those different areas.
100%.
To solve it.
Pardon the pun.
Yeah. Well done. Ba-doom-tsh. And then you throw in all the other acronyms. We're not even going into STEAM or STEM with two M's or STEAM with two A's. And if you're curious, the A generally is for art, but I lived in the Midwest. People use the A to represent agriculture. M is sometimes representing medical.
STEAM for reading.
Yep, for reading, which we're going to talk about that because I think that's another one of your areas of expertise. But for me, it sounds like STEAM is more in alignment with the idea of being a Renaissance person than science on its own. Would you agree with that?
Yes, specifically from the practitioner's point of view. And that is something that I've found that I wish to advocate for moving forward in the second half of my career. We do put a lot of emphasis on the importance of STEAM, STEM with two M's, STEAM, any of the integration that you want to include, that all of them are valid in their own ways. And perhaps we would be more successful with that approach if we could separate it into what is the practitioner doing to help students understand the importance of that integration, or at least that overlap, versus what we're actually having the kids do. And so looking at ourselves first as educators, that's where I've put a lot of organization in my practice. Like, what are we doing right now? Are we identifying a problem? Are we observing phenomenon? Are we recording our observations? Are we using those observations to try to apply them to another area, to synthesize data, to look at how this problem relates to another problem, or this phenomenon relates to another phenomenon? An example is just helping students understand the direction of global winds and how they affect surface ocean currents and how that's different than the deep ocean current. That's on the science side of things. But then later, we could use that to try to build a boat that would go across the ocean with as minimal amount of materials in a STEM-focused day. So that, as a practitioner, we can easily do that. If you're a science teacher, you can be talking with the math teacher. You can be talking with the art teacher. You can be talking with the social studies teacher, and going at bare minimum to see what their lessons are doing at that time. Looking at the whole day of a sixth grader and how we can be giving those bridges. I've been saying bridges, just for lack of a metaphorical term. How we can be working together to at least make that students experience more cohesive. So it's a massive task at a team level across an entire grade span to adopt that type of cohesive approach across the staff is a really tall task. It's not necessarily within their job description, but I'm always popping into the art teacher's room like, hey, migratory bird day is coming up in May. I give a coloring sheet. Can we turn it into a coloring contest? I've done similar coloring contests with our media center on Save a Straw, including that as part of a student service learning project that they do for the county. Or I'm going to the social studies teacher and finding out, okay, how is your writing heuristic similar to what we're doing in science for a claim, evidence, and reasoning? Maybe we could just make our own slides look the same because kids are overwhelmed with the task of writing. So maybe if we made the task of writing a little bit more similar, homogenous across different topics, then they'd understand that the goal is still the same for the students. We're just needing to make the practice a little more consistent. So my focus in helping understand how to do STEAM or STEM, whatever you want to call it, is more about what we can be doing as practitioners to just make it more accessible for ourselves and other students. And without that camaraderie or that community in a school, if you're doing it from an organic level like I am, not as a school or a county mandate or initiative, then it does put the impetus on teachers individually to feel excited to do that. But you get results fast. And that's been one of my most exciting realms. So even asking the math teacher to look at a map that we're doing on winds, global winds or ocean currents, and then them writing a question about ratios of water or wind or some relationship between natural variables on land, then the kids answering that, knowing that they just did that a week prior in their math class, like that's where you get the light bulbs. So I guess it comes from integration, but after 10 years, I have not figured out the formula to get other people on board with that kind of approach. I just keep doing it on my own.
Yeah, well, what I would say is you're connecting the dots. You're doing exactly what the title of this podcast is you're connecting the...
I had not gotten there. You got there for me. Thank you.
Yeah. So you're someone who I've really looked up to as I've had the opportunity to be in school with you, as I've had the opportunities to collaborate with you. You are inherently a dot connector and a person who I would say takes a systems perspective and asks those kind of systems thinking questions of how is X connected to Y, connected to Z, and how can I help the teachers, my colleagues, understand that what they're doing is connected to what I'm doing, what's is connected to the person down the hallway's class, and then translating that to the students and connecting the dots for the students. One of those questions that we've heard 40 bazillion times when it comes to math class. When am I going to ever use this again? You're teaching me ratios. When am I going to ever use this again? But what you're doing is you're helping the teachers see that they can give their students an opportunity to use this again, and not just in the future, like someday when you're cooking, you're going to have to do ratio. No, it doesn't have to be the future. It can be like next week in social studies, or it could be an art class or something like that. And you're connecting that dot in a shorter time frame, which is important for children and young people because they aren't thinking about that future when they have their own children. And they're not thinking about, oh, yes, when I'm in college. Like, you have to help students, especially when you're thinking about what you're going to inspire them with. You have to think more short term. You don't tell students who are in sixth grade about college. You say when you're in eighth grade, when you're in high school. And that means so much more to them because they haven't been around that long.
100% agreed, especially when it comes to the academic risks that you're trying to get the students to be able to take, especially right now, this particular bubble of students that's going through. So I teach sixth grade. So they are the ones whose kindergarten was interrupted. And we can completely see that the lack of executive function, even the lack of manual dexterity. And I predict that we'll have a lot of that with next year's sixth graders whose kindergarten was mostly remote, at least in this
state. What do you mean by manual dexterity for people who aren't familiar with that or executive function?
Have you seen that poster, Everything I Ever Needed to Learn, I Learned in Kindergarten?
Yes, that's true.
I don't remember all the examples, but it's a really long poster and it is impressive. The foundational skills.
We'll find it and put it in the show notes.
Yeah, please do that. I need it for me.
Take a drink.
The concept that there's so much that goes into those foundational skills that the kindergarten teachers are getting in with those students. And if it's interrupted in any way, we can expect a ripple. So the ripples that I'm directly observing right now, and maybe this won't always be the case, but certainly right now, is the confusion between a conversation or instruction. So there's a lot of rhetoric out there this specific year of the kids just constantly interrupting. They're not trying to be disruptive. They're not trying to be rude or create a dynamic of, you know, adversity in the classroom, but they just cannot let a human being finish another sentence. That's a skill of listening, just a response and an answer. And so we're kind of past the concern of age appropriate responses to direction or indirection, but just like what skills they need to be able to respond to instruction and anything traditional, regardless of it being too formal or too, you know, claustrophobic or, you know, not addressing all the learners' needs. I think teachers do a great job of responding to all the students' individual learning needs. Some need to be able to move around. Some need to be able to be available one day and have their head down the next day. I think there's a lot that teachers are already doing to inherently address multiple learning styles in the classroom. That's our job. That's what we're trying to do. But what we're seeing now is just a completely just unpracticed group of students. So I joke that we've just spent the last 4 months just getting these kids ready to do school. And that's something we do in September and October and not necessarily through January. So just now seeing our students develop those basic maturities to be available to learn. That's the executive function side. And then the other parts of that are, you know, just what they physically can and can't do with their bodies. So holding scissors, holding pens, holding pencils, spending time either coloring or labeling or working and understanding the concepts of what the label diagram gives them. And for us, the more often we can have them work with the same label diagram, the better, because we want them working through reflecting on their progress each day by adding more information and more interaction with labeled phenomena, but also just having them develop skills and even just the quality of an arrow that they can draw to something and label it. We're seeing very little practice of being able to do these kinds of things. So there's some very basic skills that there's a gap in right now.
I think almost everybody heard conversations about learning loss during the pandemic, but I don't think I heard any conversations about learning loss being about the ability to hold a pen and draw an arrow. Like the conversations were, oh, you know, they don't have a reading level. They're fighting with their peers. There's some of that like interpersonal interaction part that you talked about that they don't have, but the inability to let the teacher finish giving instructions before they interrupt.
Yep.
I don't think I've heard that in any of the learning loss conversations. So First off, I don't like the term learning loss.
Neither.
I never liked it during the pandemic. And I'll find some of the articles I've read, put them in the show notes about why we should critique the use of that term and what it implies. Mm-hmm. However, just because I don't like the term learning loss and what's implied with that doesn't mean that the pandemic didn't have a huge effect. Are people, other than you and your fellow teachers, are people in levels higher up who could actually make a difference having conversations about these things? Or is it that the teachers are kind of stuck figuring it out on their own?
I think a combination of both. The one thing that, and I agree with you, the learning loss is just too dismissive of understanding what type of learning was lost. And I think they learned a lot. I think they learned a lot, probably more than we give them credit for, about a completely different set of things that is now expected to be done at a quote unquote normal learning life in formal ed. So, you know, should the curriculum have been adapted for that? I'm really not sure. I think we're just now learning. I think by the time these students go through the K-12, then we'll know what they learned and what they didn't know. And we're trying to, you know, not build the airplane while it's in flight, but fix it before it is in flight. Like there's just so much going on to diagnose that. And that's not within the teacher's realm of understanding. That's not what they signed up for. They're tasked to try to get the students to be able to do those things.
And this is leading to burnout too, I imagine.
It's a lot.
Extreme burnout in the teachers.
It can be a lot. And I've observed that upon reentry from COVID, because every year has been a totally different set of challenges. So they're very different from the year before. This year's really stood out for that. So for me, I guess I've found some intrinsic inspiration. Well, all the more reason to try to make sure that there's some at least visual consistency between one class to another. If they're asked to write a claim, well, that's a claim in one class, but a hook in a different class, or vice versa. Like maybe we should just call it all claim or call it all hook, because if we can make those things a little bit more similar, then they at least have that connection. I can't speak to everything that students learned when they were at home in kindergarten in their interruptions, but I can say that I'll say rebellious that, you know, why do I need to know this? definitely stands out. So I do focus on like, why are we learning this? And I'm sure a lot of teachers have adopted that into their practice. We should always be doing that. But my slides almost always begin now with, why are we doing this? What is the why? And the why is to be able to describe anything. It doesn't have to be a scientific phenomenon, it's just anything. Can you describe the thing that is happening right now? And identify some solutions, or at least how other people have approached solving this problem? And can you even visualize yourself solving this problem through making a diagram or even cutting something out or building something? So all the more reason to involve the hands-on STEM activities as much as possible in the science classroom, just to try to integrate those tasks. It provides more interest for them, and it provides more buy-in. So as challenging as these last couple of years have been, it has been inspiring. Like, well, what can I do better? What can I do to really bridge these gaps that they're having without working harder?
Yeah. It's very interesting that you bring it up, the idea of having to give the why before you get the buy-in, because that is one of the differences that Knowles created a theory of andragogy, which is different than pedagogy. Mm. So pedagogy, root word is coming from peda, same as pedophile. It involves youth. That's the Latin root. Whereas andragogy comes not from androgynous, but from the andra root of man or adult. And so the idea is, when you teach adults, you have to think differently. It is a little bit more that youth, I don't like the idea, which comes from the idea of behavioralism, which is like, kids are a sponge and you just pour the knowledge in and they're going to soak it up. Most educators do not believe that anymore. They believe in other different theories of learning, about cognitive interaction, social, all these different things. Mm. But kids are inherently drawn to learning new things and exploring new things and asking questions and all that sort of stuff. And so school and school learning is more natural to them, I would guess, versus with adults, they want to be able to apply what they're learning. And so one of the pillars that Knowles came up with is that if you're doing adult education, you need to give the why to the adults to get buy-in. So I use that a lot in the workshops that I lead. So I might be leading a workshop on disability and accessibility awareness, as I did with Meryl Evans, amazing person for that topic. Follow her on LinkedIn. I'll put a link in the show notes. We worked with out-of-school educators in the state of New York. And we did a 4-part training series about like 101 for accessibility. We talked about accessibility in the workplace. We talked about engaging with youth. And then we talked about being an ally. And for each of those, we gave them a why at the beginning. Like, why should you pay attention to this? Why should you not have another window open on your computer? Because we were also doing this virtually. Why shouldn't you have another window open on your computer? Or why shouldn't you be working, you know, feeding your dog and doing whatever? Because in virtual land, you can do all those other things. And if they don't have that buy-in, adults are not going to spend their limited amount of intellectual focus on what you're doing. And that's why mandatory training, if they don't do it, people mentally check out. They're like, why do I have to be here? This is not even applicable to what my job is. Yep. And so it's really interesting to see that like, those youth are a little bit more aligned with these theories of how we educate adults, because maybe they were forced to grow up faster? I don't know. What do you think?
Certainly. I mean, I guess I had not connected that so much of why I was taught about the why, like professional development at the educator level. We need to be focused on the why of what we're doing and how we're doing it and how it's accessible to all learners at all levels. And I just kind of immediately applied it to my stubborn, reluctant learners and had results. So went with it. Nobody told me to do that. If that came organically, just as the need and the necessity creating invention, then I'll take the happy accident. But it has made a big difference. And in the reflection as a result of that change in strategy, I see it directly reaching these students who have substantially interrupted attention spans too. So just with that overnight change, an example is I've partly in inspiration and working with you and learning more about Renaissance women, I changed one of my lesson introductions to how could I use my travels to actually learn with my students on topics I don't know anything about. So the example is the Silk Road in China and how the climate to a certain degree must have allowed for the Silk Road to be even possible. And we were studying geography and climate and science. And so I threw up the pictures of me having the great fortune of being able to go to China and not know very much about the Silk Road or its history while I was there, just the basics that were taught and how I heard that they were learning about the dynasties and the creation of the Silk Road and all that over history. So I posted that as my why. We're learning this in science right now because I want to learn what y'all are learning in social studies. And let's connect that because I'm not sure if they're talking about the climate across this massive geography in social studies. And I saw it with my own eyes, just how big of an area that we're talking about. In China myself, like, let's learn. And by the end of the week, let's be able to talk about it. And we did that. And it was a very small change with a very large result that kind of embedded the why without even a lot of effort. So it could be just the change that I needed to do to get through to these very short attention spans. But it was the first time in months that I was able to finish a story and finish a storyline with them so that they could see the why instead of just thinking that they were going to science class, whether they thought it was boring or not. So I guess that challenge to educators trickles down in different ways in practice. And yeah. I was lucky to bump into something that seems to be working for now.
So if you were intrigued by that topic, I have a book to recommend.
Please.
That I actually had to read for a wonderful class that I took at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It was in the botany department. It was basically referred to as botany for non-science majors. Even though I was a science major, I was doing atmospheric and oceanic science. I will put a link in to the show notes about the professor who taught this course because he was extremely unique, wonderful person. But we read a book called Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Oh, amazing book.
Mm-hmm. This was the assignment to read that book. And that was huge. Yeah, I think personally, that's a wonderful example of a book that does that connecting the dots between the science, the climate, the movement of people, the cultural changes, the technological innovations. Where did fire come from? Where did farming come from? I mean, it's just wonderful book. Anybody who wants to be stimulated, that is one that I would definitely put on my book list.
Please.
But I think that's like one of those examples where an author is successfully able to pull it all together. So yeah, you inspired me to think of a book I haven't thought about for a while.
That's really my life dream. I mean, that's why I'm here today, is to learn those skills for what filmmakers that I know who've been successful with doing the same kinds of culminating projects, like Riddle in the Bottle by the Cispro Productions. I have to drop them and I have to put them in the show notes. They are the massive inspiration that brought me from running wildlife film festivals through all of my career to today. Like, I'm here to drop their name. Like Daniel Corman with his short stories and magazines of pulling all of the recreation with hydrology and history together, whatever the concepts are. I've always been highly inspired by that. I'd like to see that in these next steps of my career. I'm kind of in the reflection stages right now of like, what is most inspiring to me. And I think this concept, let alone you building a platform for people to pull those concepts together and with the connecting to the dots theme, I think it does a lot to speak to people like me. Like, no, I can make a meaningful contribution. I may not know how yet. I may need to figure out how to pull all these skills together, but it's out there. And there's people who want to work together to build those visions.
Yeah, that takes me to a question that I've asked other guests on the show so far. And I know you've gotten to listen to their answers, which is along the lines of you are kind of in the process of really feeling like you're living out the idea of being a Renaissance woman. I argue that you are one. You have a Renaissance mindset. You are a person who loves to learn for the sake of learning. And you also know inherently that serendipity will arise and you'll find a place to use that information, to share it with others, to teach other people, to like have an impact. So from that standpoint, I think you are there in the mental, but you're still in the process in your career. And what I'd be curious to hear from you is, to this point in time, where have you felt most fulfilled as a Renaissance person? When have you had those, even if it's just moments, not necessarily the job itself, but maybe it's a moment, maybe it's a project, maybe it is a collaborative team that you've been on where you're like, yes, I am embraced for the fact that I've traveled the world, that I want to combine literacy and science, for the fact that I care about diversity, equity, inclusion, access, like some places really get you and embrace you and celebrate you and recognize you, and others don't get it. And I know Melissa Vining and I talked about how sometimes there's struggles in the formal education world, that at least in the big picture of formal education, this is what we do. This is how we've always done it. It's very slow to make changes because it's a very big system that's been around for a long time. But then you can also find those moments within those settings where you can do that kind of work. So where have you found that?
Well, that thought exercise has helped me try to find those. I mean, there's the famous examples of building the theses that we got to build for our work in grad school and the vision for that to pull together reading passages that focused on the relevance in reading for middle school and high school students and how travels and interviewing scientists from all over the world to independently produce those reading passages was and is still a passion of mine. So I think that the question is like, well, do you mean, Sarah, that I would go off into the world and independently produce these things? Because it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. I've tried it in a couple of different ways. But if there's an enterprising focus to that, then I'm there for it. So that's one piece. But then there's the times that I've just been given the task in a role, like you said, being on a collaborative team and being able to do that. And I was very fortunate to lead a statewide and nationwide effort with my curriculum groups in Texas. And that was a really wonderful opportunity. So with something like that, where the door opens and you're given an opportunity to build curriculum programs, and in these cases, innovative curriculum programs that really push the user interface of how students are using the curriculum and how it's aligned and how the language is accessible to them, that I enjoyed probably the most, because those are where you get to just call up old favors with people that you worked with years ago, and then finding out, oh, well, I'm involved with this writing project and I would love to write for that, and I'd love to contribute to this program. And so building programs from scratch was always kind of what I was famous for. It's what I've been recruited for with that skill. So I get to build new projects with an innovative focus kind of naturally. That's where I'm passionate about as well. But those are episodic. Those aren't necessarily the day job. So I guess the answer to your question is both. I've been able to make my own opportunities where I've been lucky enough to, but also jump on opportunities to build new programs with innovative groups. And I'd like to do more of that as well.
Wonderful. Well, when you're trying to find those new opportunities to do that type of work, and I know the episodic nature of it, oh man, it is hard. And having my own business and having to be my own boss, I'm definitely in that struggle. And it's been particularly difficult with funding slashes in the last few years to some of the programs that might have funded that type of work in the past, which means we're having to reach out to new people and having to introduce ourselves. How do you introduce your Renaissance woman self to somebody new who you're maybe hoping will fund your next big way out there, wonderfully woven, connecting the dots idea? How do you introduce yourself to them so that they realize that you are this like complex, multi-passionate person, but not overwhelm them and talk their head off for 45 minutes when they just ask you? So tell me a little bit about yourself.
Oh, you always ask the hardest questions, Sarah.
You know me, I like to jab it in there.
Well, it's unfortunate that there is a lesser satisfying way to say I help run a middle school science and STEM program for, you know, one of the most diverse counties in the United States, let alone Maryland. So like that in itself is a pretty rewarding introduction, but it only speaks to the teacher side of me. So beyond that, you know, I've tried all sorts of different elevator speeches. I resonated with things like I help bring science and media full circle. That's one that's kind of worked for me, because then that allows them to ask whatever question that they want, that they happen to get in that moment, to ask me the next question. Because if I try to push it all down somebody's throat, they're not going to get it. So if you've got a little teaser aspect to it, then that seems to help a little bit.
Make them curious. Inspire curiosity.
Yeah. make it their idea. Make curiosity their idea, not your idea. I've tried things like I'm putting the serious into making STEM easier. I'm putting the STEM into systems thinking. I've tried anything that's about me trying to bring two different things together is the fastest tagline that I've been able to do, instead of running down a list of things that I've done that maybe they do or do not relate to. But everybody can get behind a message of bringing the reading and relevance to STEM and science. Everybody can get behind the message of literacy and STEM literacy, or making STEM fun, or making science easier. I've tried to reframe any of those quick introductions to what do they care about. And really, everybody cares about making science easier and more accessible for all students, and making it more fun, and making reading easier and part of science.
I think what's really interesting about what you're saying is that it mirrors advice from my own career coach, Jenny Gritters. I'll put her in the show notes. She's there basically every week. And really, entrepreneurs who are mission-driven, values-driven, it's about how do you talk about yourself to future clients? And you don't say, this is me and I've done this, 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 and this. You speak to their pain point in the lingo of entrepreneurship. You talk to what they see as a problem, and then you talk about how you help solve that problem and how you help support them in reaching their goals. And you make it about them, not about you and all these things that you have done. And I hear a lot of alignment with that.
It comes, if I'm multi-passionate about anything, it is that there's so much emphasis on teachers focusing on making sure that students feel heard, students feel welcome, students feel safe with their learning. It's all about how you make them feel. I'm like, yeah, no, I can take that lesson and I can apply it to these much broader areas that I'm trying to reach with my approach. And nobody's available until you make sure that they know that they're ready to hear you. And that comes from years of working with great people like you. And again, this platform that you're building to help other people hear that and resonate with it, that's unique in itself. It's an inspiration at its own level. But yeah, if you're being asked, you know, what do you do for a living? It's pretty enticing to turn it around into something they're going to want to actually listen to.
And you're doing that a lot. You were talking about what you do with your student, and you give them a why of the homework assignment and you put it into a story. That's another theme that comes up so often in this podcast, is stories and storytelling and tapping into emotions and caring about the why. And I think you do that in a lot of your work. You give people, whether it's the students in your sixth grade classroom or a potential collaborator or a teacher or an administrator, a reason to listen to you because you think about what their needs are and their interests are and their why. And then you craft your message to what you think their why is.
I had underestimated how valuable that skill is for a long time. I feel like without the sense of community that you're building, it's easy to feel alone or like a maverick in that. And I used to think that that type of motivation was ongoing, always fulfilled, never run out of gas, never burn out, as long as you're seeing through with your best self and showing up with that for yourself and others. And now I understand, okay, yeah, you can still show up with that message that you're trying to get at with other people so that they have the why to even listen to you. But you need to make sure that there's a self-fulfilling aspect in that, that I'm not doing this just so I can feel heard by you at the moment. I'm truly doing this because this is important. But without that sense of belonging or community that you're building in this platform or other people who are doing the same platform, then it's easy to feel alone or isolated in that. So cheers to you for bringing that together. I see that being a very valuable thing for a lot of people.
Thank you. I think it's time for us to play a little bit, because playing is fun. And I would like to play my fill in the blank game with you, which I know you've listened to other episodes.
Ooh, this is the hardest one.
This one. You're gonna, okay, improv. Here we go. Improv. Get ready.
Here we go.
Okay. I'm going to try to come up with one that I haven't used yet. Let's think about it. So the sentence is, you're going to complete the sentence, you know you're a Renaissance person if. So I will force myself to go first and try not to come up with the same idea I've used before. You know you are a Renaissance person if you have post-it notes or voice memos or scratches on napkins all over your house with all these different things that have inspired you. And then when you go back to read them, you're like, what?
I like that. How often do you do that?
You know what? I actually literally posted today on LinkedIn that my next thing for the Renaissance People community is something to address that. What I do is I start drafts of emails and I put my idea into an email draft because I can access my email on my phone really quickly on my computer, whatever. And then I looked, I'm like, I have like 250 draft emails. I should do something with it. So when we were stuck home in the winter storm, I set a timer and I said, okay, I created a Google sheet, four columns. One that had date, one that was just for putting the content of that draft email. Third one was for what am I going to do with this? And fourth was completed. My rule was that all I did was copy and paste and put the content of the draft email into that content category and then right next to it, what's my to do with it? And I had two exceptions. My one exception was if I read it and I couldn't figure out what it meant, I just deleted it. I'm not going to keep it just in the hopes that I'm going to someday figure out my, you know, chicken scratch, if you will. And then the second rule was if I could complete the task in less than 1 minute, I was allowed to do it. So a few of the things, all I wanted to do was like copy and paste them into something that I had already organized. And I was going to do initially like 30 minutes and I ended up doing like an hour and a half and got a huge chunk of my draft emails put away. And so I'm actually going to start a group. I'm brainstorming what the name is going to be, deciding, you know, brain dump, clean up an aisle 3, and download are a few ideas that I'm asking people on LinkedIn to vote for which one they like. By the time this podcast episode comes out, I will have already decided. So sorry, folks, you don't get to vote. But my thought is let's bring Renaissance people together for 40 minutes because I don't have a paid account for Zoom. So I can only do a 40-minute meeting. We'll spend 30 minutes just dumping stuff into an organized filing system. And then the last 10 minutes sharing with each other, like what we learned, how did it feel? What are we inspired and excited to do? And that'll just be like once a month we'll meet and like clean up.
I love that.
That's my idea.
You know you're a Renaissance person when you're getting all the what seems to be disconnected ideas and then actually connecting them through a rewarding organizational practice. That's a win. That's a double win.
There you go. Okay. So now you've done yours. Should we do another round?
Oh, sure.
Can come up with another one.
I'll try.
Okay. I believe in you. You know you're a Renaissance person if, man, I'm blanking. I have some written down somewhere, but I feel like it'd be cheating to go back because I've had like months to brainstorm this. You've had days. You know you're a Renaissance person if you enjoy hosting parties where you invite friends who have what seems like no overlapping similarities between them, and you're able to curate an amazing group of people and have a fabulous conversation.
And I counter that with agreement with an example of what I've done on topic.
Yes. No. Okay. You give an example and then you have to fill in the blank again.
Goodness. Okay. You know you're a Renaissance person if somehow in every conversation, invited or not, you manage to find a way to bring the space program into it. Because the space program and all that goes into space exploration is somehow related to every single conversation you have. And then somehow make it not a quote unquote nerdy conversation, but just something that we should be like being able to talk about every day.
Love that. Are you talking about a particular Renaissance woman?
No, not at all. Only my heroes.
Not at all.
Certainly not the people before me.
I love it. Okay. Well, we're going to go to the very last part of the podcast, which is my rapidish fire questions. You don't have to be completely rapid on them, but we'll give you the opportunity to be somewhat succinct. So what is one metaphor that you find yourself using frequently? The metaphor that I'd like to share is that I often find myself talking about weaving and bringing things together. I talk about it in the area of STEM when I talk about the next generation science standards, which are literally drawn as three woven strands pulled together. For those who are unfamiliar with it, it's the idea of like the science facts you need to know, which are called the DCI, disciplinary core ideas. It's knowing how many planets there are, that sort of thing. The science and engineering practices is the second strand. And these are the things that scientists actually do. that engineers do. They make charts, they ask questions, all these things that I think in you and I have both worked in the informal science education world, and we spend a lot of time really practicing those things and worry maybe less so about memorizing the facts, which is the stereotypical idea of science and not what science is. And then the third is the disciplinary core ideas. And I think this is something, this is where I see you as a rock star, because the disciplinary core ideas are things that span across disciplines. So it's things that biologists and chemists and physics and engineers that they all do, but they're also written in such a way that they expand to history, they expand to art. And so it's things like seeing patterns. If we just said seeing patterns, you see patterns in art class, you see patterns in history, you see patterns in biology. And so those are the really expansive dot connecting beyond just the STEM, whether it's a woven thread, whether it's weaving together this network of people and all of these resources, that idea of weaving really resonates with me. And I even applied for a job once to be a network weaver.
No.
I didn't get it, but I was still part of that community, and it was a pretty awesome job description.
Oh my goodness. I love that metaphor. I agree. And they did such a good job with NGSS pulling all those concepts together through a woven piece. And I've liked how you've used the concept of the golden thread to pull together, you know, anything that the Renaissance person is trying to pull together at that stage of their thought process or their career, you know, what it is that they're reflecting on internally versus what it is they're portraying outwardly. That's a really good gift to be looking at things with that. And I guess for me, it's always just been the full circle. What two worlds are you trying to bring together, and how are you bringing them together in a seamless way? And it's maybe not two worlds, but the concept of varying themes or varying topics. How are you bringing them together full circle? And the concept that we've already maybe explored some of these areas, but then as we've learned about other things, we come back full circle and we see these things. I did have a friend argue that why would you want to see things that you'd already seen? So there is a little bit of a pragmatic flaw to the concept of a full circle, but that's always stood out with me. I mean, it's in my tag name. It's in my full circle classroom concept, like it's all there. But if there is a metaphor, if that truly meets that definition, it would be full circle. What worlds are we bringing together full circle, and why?
Like that. We talked Venn diagram, brought up that way at the very beginning of our conversation. And what is a Venn diagram but overlapping circles? So there's that idea of a circle again. And a circle is a cycle. We talked about cycles. I did a arts integration course through the Kennedy Center for the Arts that was integrating dance and science that I talked with my first guest, Nancy Scales Connington, about. And it was talking about like a cycle is something in dance, in music, and in science, and in history. And I can see that idea of like a circle and a cycle in a lot of the work that you do.
I listened to that and I was really inspired by that. I've done quite a bit with hand motions, especially when we were teaching virtually, of using hand motions to connect the concepts of heat transfer with other ideas or whatever, the quick inspiration just to fill in that moment. But yeah, the concept of movement with any learning is always going to be a connect for anybody. Good job on highlighting that in your work.
And thank you, Nancy, for sharing your ideas too about that.
Yes. Yeah. Nancy's awesome.
She's the best. Well, okay. What is, you've shared some of these, but what's another rabbit hole that you've recently gone down? What's something that you've been digging into that doesn't connect to anything else that you, or I'm sure it connects, but isn't directly related to anything you've said so far?
Oh gosh, no, it's not connected to anything that I've said so far. It is a recent inspiration, and I love the concept of looking at not just gamified learning and not just serious learning or serious game learning, whatever that concept is, but the concepts of how we can respond to the element of randomness in learning. So like D&D, oh, just this golden chest of content that we're sitting on for bringing in any element of game development, game concepts in learning. There was an example recently that came up, but anytime you can bring in the element of randomness in games, rolling the dice, spinning the wheel, that has been such a fun, refreshing way to look at some of these recent problems that we're having, of just making things easier in our own lives, let alone our own classrooms. So anything game or the history of magic or the history of games. That has been a big inspiration of mine. I'd really like to bring that into space exploration education because we don't get to teach enough of that in middle school. And that's just such a huge basis of STEM careers, and talk about the golden thread, and space applies to everything, right? So that's been a huge level of inspiration for me. It's in its infancy, but it's still fun. I just got done with like playing a little like, let's look at the history of magic and see how I could apply it to this week's lessons on geology.
And for people who don't know, you're not talking about like the history of magic as in like magical spells and stuff like that. You're talking about Magic the game, right?
Yeah, just games. Yeah, just games. What are games? That's been so much fun.
That's awesome. Well, you'll have to share a few of your favorite, maybe most inspirational things that have gotten you to think a lot. And we'll put it into the show notes for other people who want to follow you down that wonderful path.
Well, and if it's still out there, I hope it is. I was hoping to put in the show notes the NASA spinoffs wheel. There had been a game that they'd made for kids with the NASA spinoffs, and you could easily access for any grade, like just spinning the wheel, to get all sorts of different spinoffs that the NASA program had made, just because those inventions that had been made in space directly helped the people on Earth and vice versa. And that I have to give credit to them. I can't find it, but when I do, I'll put it in the show notes.
We shall dig for it. Dr. Cordova, who used to be the head of NSF a number of years ago, I got to hear her very first talk that she ever gave as the head of NSF when I was at a conference for folks involved in broader impacts. And the idea of broader impacts is like scientists do all this research, but they need to get it out to more people than just scientists who read journals and look at posters at science conferences. And so it's people who are involved in that, like connecting the dots work of connecting scientists outside. And one of the things she did was she put up a slide, and it included all these innovative things that came from NASA's research. And it was really intriguing to see. There have been times where people have pushed back against research because they didn't understand. One big thing was when they were making fun of people who built a robot that could fold laundry. And people were like, yes, but this could lead to a tool to help people who have lost a limb. This tendency, if you don't understand the science research, and then you just hear this title that seems kind of funny, that it's easy to make fun of it or just be like, that makes no sense. Why do we need to know what plant will grow in space? But then we can take what plant will grow in space and then we can test that out in Liberia, in Antarctica. We can bring it back to Earth.
You get it.
And just because it's research in space, it doesn't mean that it doesn't apply to us. It's the why. We have to have that why, and we have to help people understand the why should I care about this.
Yep. And the more we do it throughout K-12 education, the better. It doesn't have to be the space unit. It can be really every day. And so that's always been a go-to for mine if I'm low on inspiration. That and wildlife conservation, they go hand in hand. So we can use the technology that we're doing in space to help wildlife on Earth. So again, they always go hand in hand.
I love it. Okay. And then the final question I'm going to ask you before finding how people can share information and learn more from you is, I want to ask you, is there anything else from your background that might surprise people? What's a juicy nugget from Jess's history that people, even people who maybe have known you for quite a while, your colleagues would be like, what? You did what?
Well, every major epiphany I've ever had in my life has been on a boat. So I'm kind of feeling like if I'm at a crossroads or just a phase of my life where some new inventions are coming along or new guidance for my life, I need to go on a boat. But I only recently made that connection and doing some recon. So the idea to build the interactive reading passages was on my travels from here to there. And the writing my thesis was done on a boat in Belize for a month. And I've just had so many wonderful opportunities that I haven't really had time to connect. But now looking at my whole family of world travelers and how many stories we have not been able to tell because we've been so busy doing life, and knowing that just about every major life-changing decision I've made has been on a boat with someone who has less than average access to a boat. I'm not near a boating community. It's not part of my life. Like, I'm feeling like there's some tie in there. And I carried an elk out of the forest by myself once.
Wow. Okay. So with the boat one, I think there's a metaphor. And I'm expecting a really well thought out, blog post or LinkedIn post about that, because I feel like there's got to be some sort of metaphor going on there.
Challenge accepted.
And I was thinking back, and I think I told you this, I think the very first time, at least that I remember interacting with you, John Graves was teaching a class that you and I were both in. He is the rock star for virtual education. He is retired now, but he's amazing. Thank you, John.
Hi, John.
We love you. And I am almost certain that either we were in a meeting or everybody was like posting their like, hi, my name is, and telling a little bit about themselves in the introduce you thread. And yours was, hi, I'm Jess. I'm currently in a boat off of an island in Greece and interviewing scientists for a project that I have, or something along that line. Like, I swear, you said that you were on a boat in that very first introduction when I met you. So I find it so intriguing that you come back with the story.
Hey, you and me both. Like I said, this is a recent epiphany of mine. I'm like, well, if that's the case, then I'll just jump on a boat and get some more ideas.
You need to buy a houseboat, lady. You gotta like move to the sea or a lake.
Yeah, or take on another research internship like the one I got to do in Greece or something.
There you go.
Just bring that learning onto boats so I can bring that back. If I can't get to space, then maybe I could get on a boat.
There we go. Well, so much research on like how we survive in space is done underwater. Water.
There you go.
To simulate.
With the NEMO program. That's incredible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we could go on forever, but I'm going to cut our time since we've been talking for almost an hour. And I want to thank you for joining me. For folks who want to continue following you on this Renaissance woman journey as these new ideas percolate and become something, what's the best way for them to continue to follow you and maybe reach out to you if they want to collaborate?
Oh, I'm on LinkedIn. Find me there, Jessica, Jess Rowell. I'm there. I do have my portfolio, and I think it's linked to my LinkedIn. And that's where I'll have my stories of my travels and how they make my education work and what I'm most passionate about. So the portfolio link is on my LinkedIn profile.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, Jess. And I look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. Thank you for everything you're doing for all those Renaissance people out there. They've got to hear your message. You're doing great work.
We're awesome. Thank you.
Connecting the dots with the Renaissance people.